Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome, you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Dave.
We have a new family member to talk about, Tim.
That's what I hear.
Yes, over on the Podcast One family side, we have a new program that just launched. And I don't know if you're aware of this, Tim, but our listeners kind of have a fondness for true crime.
Boy, do they.
We stumbled upon that accidentally a little over 8 years ago. Filling 1 week, we started talking crime stories, and it's been a part of our world ever since. Now we have a true crime podcast every Tuesday, as you know, True Crime Tuesday. And Podcast One came to us and they said, guys, we know your audience eats up true crime. We have a brand new program that's beginning, and we would love for you guys to talk to the hosts. And let's give it a shot. Let's listen to this. And I love the focus on this, Tim. Something unlike most podcasts out there, especially when it comes into the true crime vein. And I like it because it plays very much into our theater of the mind programming that we do here on this show. Mm-hmm. In the way that they do this, they present it in a completely different way. Whereas you and I handle interviews more and dealing with the authors or sometimes the police or even the victim in some cases, talking with them for an hour to 90 minutes. This really is a broader scope podcast and goes over this series in around 10 or possibly even more episodes. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. It's available every Monday on Podcast One. And it's definitely a case that nightmares are made of. It's also known as the DC Mansion Murders, and it's a brand new true crime series telling the very frightening story of a DC power couple, their 10-year-old son and housekeeper. And I don't want to tell you too much about it because we've got the actual hosts of the show on with us today, Tim. Oh. We're going to find out about this and their background involved in this case. Megan Clarity and Jack Moore are here. Megan, thank you very much for joining the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Jack, thank you for joining as well.
Thank you, too.
All right. You know, getting involved in true crime, it is a passion for people. I mean, there are entire networks dedicated to just following true crime. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's interesting to me is always trying to find a story that has something different, a twist, a weird angle on it. And you guys have certainly got one. I got to tell you, I had a chance to listen to the first episode and I love it. And I don't say that lightly. I'm so sometimes overwhelmed by the amount of programming out there and what's offered. You guys have such a great and professional podcast put together on this. So I want to congratulate you on that. And boy, you know, if car washes and working at Cub Foods doesn't work out for you, you guys should look at becoming reporters.
Thank you. I actually, this project, you were saying, you know, it's kind of hard to find a case that has the intricacies that you're looking for to report. But actually, this is the only podcast we've ever done. We are both reporters here in Washington, D.C., and we covered this crime the day it happened. And so we really didn't know what it was going to be. And then we followed it. I mean, we can obviously go into the intricacies of actually what happened, but basically it was a murder in a house, and it was a house that was, you know, a couple blocks from the vice president's house here in D.C., just around the corner from Embassy Row, if you're familiar with the city. A really, really nice neighborhood, upscale neighborhood. And firefighters rush to this house because there's a fire reported. It's the middle of the day. They think it's like a chimney fire or something, because who's home in the middle of the day? And it turns out that they find three adults and a child's body inside the house. And then soon, you know, within hours, we learn that they did not die from the fire, that there were suspicious circumstances. And this thing just begins to unravel and unravel and unravel. And we followed it through until the trial of the man who was eventually convicted in the killings 3 years later. And at the point of the trial, that's when we were like, oh, my God, there are a lot of details here that we can't possibly get in our daily reporting. You know, I mean, I'm a radio reporter, right? So I get like 40 seconds for my stories, which is pretty crazy. And Jack's works on our website. And so he has a little more latitude. But generally, we wanted to cover the same things every day. And we were just talking about, you know, gosh, how are we going to get to this detail? Or this doesn't make sense. I wonder how that's going to play out. And we started sort of recording what we were talking about, which we can go into that as well. But the story really turned on us, and we had decided to cover it long before. So it's not like we chose the story. It kind of happened organically, actually.
Well, that's interesting as well. And Jack, maybe you can answer to this. So, you know, Washington, D.C., many people hear that and they think, OK, prestige, politics, business. This is a hub. But as my understanding is, Washington, D.C. is really kind of stands out for crime and a lot of very violent and strange crime. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think Washington, D.C. is a large city, and, you know, crime is something that happens in all large cities. I would say, you know, D.C.'s murder rate, I guess, recently has actually been kind of on a downswing, upswing. I mean, nothing compared to the 80s or the 90s, you know, when it was murder capital of the country. I think, though, you know, really this crime, there is no comparisons with really anything else that had happened in the city in recent memory. You know, this was kind of sui generis, if I'm saying that correctly. I mean, there was just nothing. I think that's why it was so shocking to people, because of where it was, you know, this really wealthy enclave of D.C., but also because, I mean, no matter where this would have happened, it just would have been shocking to people.
But I guess, you know, people, and maybe it's just me, but, you know, Tim and I have spoken about it. And you know, when my kids will hear stories come out of Washington, D.C., you said, you know, not so long ago, it was the murder capital.
Yeah.
When you think of Washington, D.C., you think of the president, you think this place has got to be one of the highest security and probably the safest places on the planet to live. And yet it's had quite a tumultuous past. How, in a city that is big and it's a working city, and there are crimes daily, as you point out, how did this story stand out so much that it enthralled you to the fact that you wanted to share all of the intricacies with us? Was there something different that made this story set itself apart from the daily grind of crime, or was it just the amount of strange things that really drew you to it?
I think actually it was both. I mean, I'm actually a crime and courts reporter, so I probably should have answered the question, because a lot of the crime we cover in D.C., I mean, if people forget, it is the nation's capital, but it's also a city where people live, right? So it's not just government buildings and, you know, super security around the Capitol building. There are neighborhoods where there's gang activity, there's drug activity. I mean, there's kind of anything you'll find in any city. And yeah, we were, I mean, back in the 80s, we were kind of notorious for the violence here. It really came under, back in 2015, they really got it down. I mean, it was way lower than the majority of cities, big cities under New York, under LA. And now we're kind of seeing a tiny bit of an uptick. But I think not only was the location odd, the circumstances were odd. There was no obvious motive. And Jack and I talk about that, and we're happy to talk about it with you. In this killing, so three adults were killed and a child. The motive, in my mind, should have been clear out of the gate, right? I mean, we were initially thinking, okay, does it have something to do with the father's business? Or, you know what I mean? Like, what right. could it immediately be? And it didn't come quickly. Police took a week to find the guy who did this. And then there was the whole question of, did he do it by himself? And so for years, we were kind of under the understanding, based on police, you know, police records and affidavits and what have you, that they may be, you know, trying to look for somebody else, trying to find other DNA. Maybe the person who they arrested was going to flip on somebody else. I mean, there was this mystery around who did it. And then you have the lives of the people who were taken, who passed away in this. And their stories are just, I mean, it's so, I don't even know how to, it was like a normal day, you know, in their lives. There was nothing really special about it. I mean, the dad went to work. The mom took her kid to the doctor's office. She went for a walk that day. I mean, it was just like, why that day? Did he plan it? There were so many questions that we had that it didn't really have to do with the murder standing out because necessarily of, you know, that it was in this fancy house or I don't know. It just had to do with how it kept sort of unveiling itself.
Right.
More details kept becoming, you know, maybe suspicious, or we were like, does that make sense? And so we just kept latching on with interest. And I think Jack has something to add.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes the case particularly haunting, and that I think can make anyone really put themselves in that situation, is that while the family and their housekeeper, Vera Figueroa, were being held for 22 hours, nearly a day, they made a number of calls to the outside world to arrange a $40,000 ransom, which was dropped off, to call family members, the business, and nobody seemed to know what was going on. They were able to maintain some kind of normalcy. So we believe that their kidnapper was forcing them to make all of these calls, and they couldn't, you know, let on what was really happening. But it's horrifying, you know, to, if you were one of those people on the other end of that phone call, to realize you talked to your loved one and they were, you know, being held against their will and later killed, and you had no idea. So I think that it's very, I mean, anybody could imagine, could put themselves in that situation and think, well, my God, what would I do? And do you try to send some kind of secret signal, or, you know, do you have to have some kind of safe word? You know, it just is, you know, it is horrifyingly captivating.
Talk to me about the family leading up to this, and who they were, what they did in their lives, and what was a typical day like for them? Is it am I saying this right? The Savopoulos family?
Yeah, we actually, it's Savopoulos, but in the beginning, when we were reporting it, you know, you get the name written out by police. So we had initially reported it Savopoulos. It's Sava Savopoulos is the father. They're a Greek family. Sava Savopoulos' father immigrated over to DC when before he was born. And Sava was a businessman. He was the CEO of American Iron Works. It was actually his father's company that he took over, a metalworking company, about a half hour drive from where this crime happened, at his house in Northwest Washington. And by all accounts, he was a really great guy. I mean, everything that we've heard about him, he ran his business well. He treated his employees well. He was very philanthropic. It's funny when you do a story like this, and it's sort of, you know, we released episode one this past Monday, and we're getting all these emails from people like, I knew Sava when I went to college with him, and we had this project we were working on, and he took us all out to a really nice dinner, and I couldn't believe it because we were in college and we're used to eating it like, you know, the dorm, and he took us to like a really nice dinner, and it was just lovely. And just like little tiny things that we're hearing about him. And I know that doesn't really matter, but it doesn't seem like anybody has a bad word. His wife, Amy, was a stay-at-home mom. She had three kids. The two older daughters were away at boarding school and were not home when this happened. Her 10-year-old son, Philip, was the child who was killed in this murder. And she, I mean, by all accounts, was lovely as well. Very down to earth. Loved, like obsessed with coffee. Like, couldn't get enough coffee in her day. Loved walking everywhere. So she was big into exercise. And we interview one of her friends who knew her from kind of when they were dropping off and picking up kids in their younger days, when you're just sitting on the side of a soccer field. And she just said, you know, she didn't have enough nice things to say about Amy and how wonderful she was. And then Philip was 10. Loved Hot Wheels, loved racing cars, like just into racing in general, loved baseball. He was in Little League. And, you know, we heard he was just kind of a special kid. We heard that when he talks to his sisters, excuse me, on the phone, he would ask them, you know, what was the hardest part of your day today so I can pray about it tomorrow in chapel? Because he went to a pretty well-known school here, St. Albans, which is right on the grounds of National Cathedral. But it is a religious school, so they went to chapel every day. So, and then we have Vera Figueroa, who is the family's housekeeper. She was just there doing her job, and she was supposed to leave at 3 o'clock that day, and she never got the chance to. And she was also held against her will and tortured along with the family and killed. She was about to retire. I mean, she was like a couple years from retiring. She had kids back in El Salvador she wanted to go see. She hadn't seen since Christmas. She was married, loved like dancing and going out with friends. And it, I mean, they're just completely normal. You know, I mean, the family had the family was very wealthy. I mean, they shared their wealth and they had super, you know, super expensive sports car in their garage. I mean, so I don't necessarily think that's not normal by, you know, what does normal mean? But at the same time, it's I mean, Vera couldn't have been more normal. You know, she was an immigrant. She was working every day, working her butt off and planned to go home that night to her husband and never did.
You hear a story like this and you almost want there to be a reason, right? That Mr. Savalopes, oh God, Savalopes, nice way to say it, Dave.
Savopoulos.
Savopoulos, yes. Yeah. Mr. Savopoulos was some, you know, double dealing,
right,
horrible guy, or they were, you know, snobby rich people who looked down upon their workers. You want to think that there has to be some justification for this. Not that that is a reason, but you know what I'm going for is it just it's unimaginable that this is just a really good family, a really good set of people, and crime comes knocking on the door of anybody. It's indiscriminate, right? I mean, that's the sad aspect of this. You can be a church going, good hearted, middle income family, very wealthy family, poor income family, and it doesn't matter. When it comes for you. And this is unfortunately a glaring case where it came in a very horrific way. Now, the family itself, when they were discovered, were there quite a few suspects, or was it just like this grasping at straws? What happened? Who could have done something like this?
Well, I think that was the question on everyone's mind. And initially it was a mystery. There was a lot of rumor, a lot of speculation about it had to be some kind of business, you know, business dealings gone wrong, or even, you know, something like, oh, it had to be the mob, or, there had to be something, you know, to explain this. But and for a while, police were looking into the backgrounds of everyone. I mean, they had no really real leads. And what ended up being what pointed them in the direction of the suspect who was later charged and convicted was a piece of DNA on the crust of a pizza. And the pizza had been delivered to the house the night before while the family was being held. So the suspect forced the family to order him a pizza, two pizzas, and he ate one of them and his DNA was left behind. And the house was burned, but the house was set on fire, but the fire was mostly contained to one bedroom. It didn't spread to the other bedroom, which is where the three adult victims were and where those two pizza boxes were. And when the DNA analysts swabbed the pizza crust, they found the DNA that matched Darren Wendt, the suspect. But there was, for a long time after that, when he was arrested, there was that, as Megan said, that speculation that it had to have been a group. I think mostly because of the logistics, you know, for how does one person control four people? And I think also because there was a thinking of, yes, the killer made off with the $40,000, but because the crime was so brutal, you know, does that really explain the full motivation for somebody to commit a crime like this? Mm-hmm. So that was, kind of swirling around for so long. And as Megan mentioned, there was quite a lengthy delay between when Darren Wendt was arrested in May 2015 and when he finally went on trial in September 2018, more than 3 years. And, you know, we in the outside world, we didn't really, after Darren Wendt was arrested, every few months there would be some preliminary hearings and, you know, court paperwork being filed. But we had no new information about the case until it went to trial. And so the trial was really the venue where we finally began to learn how this crime unfolded, what really happened over those 22 hours.
But Dave, that motive. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so this story is splashed across the headlines when it occurs. And then there's this tapering that until information really comes out and the police are able to and prosecutors can actually put this out there. There was, you said, 3 years from the time of the murders to the actual trial date. It must have been very strange and unsettling for people to not have answers as to what happened in their neighborhood.
Yeah, I think definitely. And I think, you know, the one thing especially was the idea that in the initial days and some of those police affidavits, there was the thinking that there were more than one person involved in this. But throughout that whole time, Darren Wendt was the only one charged. So I think that was where people were thinking, I mean, are there more people out there? That I think maybe caused the most uneasiness.
Mm-hmm. And even the pizzas. I mean, why would you order? Were you planning to have the victims eat the pizza? Why would you order two pizzas? Are you trying to make it look normal? You know what I mean? There's just a lot of things where you were thinking, well, that couldn't just be one guy. Or did he take them all at once and just overpowered Sava first? And your mind, I think, just naturally, you try and make it work. Like you try and make a narrative to this thing to make the detail fit. And eventually prosecutors were able to prove that Darren Wendt basically took them one by one and kind of laid out the timeline for that. And we go into the details of that. But I think, as Jack touched on, the motive, I mean, these people were tortured for hours and hours. I mean, they were, it seemed like a very, I mean, I'm not a criminologist, but it seemed to me like if you wanted it to be quick and just, you know, get it over with, that's not what happened. It wasn't a quick death. And so there was a certain amount of, I mean, passion might be the wrong word, but it seemed personal. And so again, the 40 grand that he walked away with and eventually was caught with, it doesn't really add up. It didn't seem like for a lot of people that was enough.
Well, let's introduce ourselves to Darren Wendt in a moment. First off, 60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? You can get an offer for your car with True Car. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a True Cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to True Car, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you get an accurate True Cash offer from a local True Car certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you. Together, you can ask questions and get answers you need, and there's no surprises. Then, simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. 22 Hours, an American Nightmare, brand new podcast series that has begun here on Podcast One. Make sure you check it out. Our guests, I should say, are the hosts of this program and the reporters that have committed so much of their lives to getting the story, understanding the story, and taking a deeper look into it. Megan Clougherty, Jack Moore are here with us today. What do we know about Darren Wendt prior to this crime? Was violence, was crime part of his past, or was this something out of the blue?
Well, Darren Wendt did have a criminal history that did involve violence, although not to this level. I mean, what could possibly rise to this level, you might ask. But what we do know about Darren Wendt is his connection to the victims. He worked for Sava Savopoulos' company. Darren Wendt was a welder. He worked for American Iron Works in the early 2000s, and he was fired for missing work. As far as we know, that's what company records indicate. And that was what was postulated at the trial. And that was 10 years before the killings. So he used to work for this company. He was fired for a relatively anodyne reason. I mean, a lot of people are fired for missing work, you know. And then 10 years go by and these killings happen. So there is a connection, although I don't want to say it's necessarily tenuous, but it doesn't seem like, you know, it's a really solid thing, you know, that would describe the brutality, right, of the killings. What else we know about Darren Wendt?
Can I ask you one thing on that, sure, that moment? In a big company like this, you've got, you know, the president of the company is often very insulated from the employees. Would he have even really known about Darren Wendt, or would it have been supervisors and, you know, just something that happened below him as a course of doing business?
I think it's a great point. It was a relatively smaller company. I think it wasn't a giant company, but the defense team tried to make that point that how often, if at all, would Darren Wendt have crossed paths with Sava Savopoulos? Darren said when he testified in his own defense that he remembers seeing Sava's dad, because remember, it was his company initially before Sava took it over. Now, I mean, if you're cynical, you would say, well, of course you'd say that. You wouldn't say, if you were on trial for murder, yes, I saw the guy all the time. But it is worth asking. I mean, how often? It's not like Sava is on the welding floor. You know, he's in the office doing his thing. So I don't think it's even clear that Sava was the one who fired Darren. That was never made clear either. I think it may have just been his direct manager. So, there's sort of a not really a tangible connection so much there.
Right. And we do have, like, prosecutors were able to pull Darren Wendt's search history from his phone, you know, like every search he ever tapped into his phone. And there's no indication that he ever searched for the Savopoulos address, the Savopoulos family, the name of the company, even in the, you know, before the murders, you know, in the weeks and months before the murder. So where the idea came from, how he got to the house, how he found himself there is a mystery that we don't know.
They can get that in depth into your phone searches to tell everything you've done and everything you've looked up to that point.
I mean, it's crazy these trials now, your cell phone is such a huge part of the evidence that's presented. I mean, we have cell phone pings that show if you send a text message while you're driving, obviously don't do that. Or if you're calling or whatever on Bluetooth, wherever your cell phone is pinging off of, like the nearest tower, they have records of that. So if you say, nah, I was in Chicago and it's pinging off of, you know, a Peoria tower. I mean, no, you weren't. You know what I mean? Like they can trace where you are. And there's no, what's interesting too about Darren Wendt, as far as his digital activity, he didn't have a cell phone plan. He had a phone, but he would, like, wherever he went, he would connect to the Wi-Fi there.
Right.
And so when he was traveling, he doesn't have Wi-Fi. So we didn't have his cell phone. There was no activity. That was another right, very damning thing from the prosecution. There was no activity during the time that these 22 hours this family was being held in Vera. Darren Wendt basically goes completely silent.
That leads to a lot of strange questions as well, then, right? I mean, how do you go? How do you orchestrate something like this, especially if you're on your own? How do you orchestrate something like this and not stumble, not make a call, not make a text? I mean, that just seems to be such a part of who everyone is.
Well, I think, and it goes to Megan's point of if he wasn't able to access Wi-Fi, he couldn't use his phone. So in a way, it really is a double-edged sword. So in a way, you know, even though most people with your cell phone can tell you your exact location, where you were on a particular day, because Darren Wendt's phone never connected to a cell network, it doesn't show that he was at the house on Woodland Drive over those 2 days, but it doesn't show that he was anywhere, you know? So it's a double-edged sword, because by the same token, we also know he was an avid Facebook user, and most days, you know, he was sending dozens of messages. And then, as Megan said, over those 2 days that the crime unfolded, he sends zero. So then you can use his digital profile to circumstantially say, well, what, you know, over the 2 days these people were murdered and your DNA is in that house. Also, you mysteriously go dark on your social media profile. But they couldn't, you know, they could never conclusively say your phone was at 3201 Woodland Drive where these four people were murdered.
You get fired. In most cases that we hear these traumatic shootings that take place, it always seems to be within a relatively short period of time. I think maybe up to 3 years is the longest I've ever heard. Somebody comes back and retaliates because, you know, you find out later that their life just fell to shambles after they were let go or that they were treated poorly at work. But usually it's a pretty quick turnaround. A 10-year span, this guy waited to retaliate. So it doesn't seem, and I don't want to say that. I say that lightly because, it, you know, not necessarily a retaliation for this. Is it a crime of convenience? It's not a retaliation. It's just that this is the wealthiest guy he knows. This is the person that if you need money right now, right away, this is the guy you're going to tap to get that.
It's interesting, too, because the motive really comes down to money. The prosecution said, you know, Darren went, basically, he had been out of a job for about 2 years. He was a welder, which is not, I mean, something you can, I could go and just do tomorrow. I mean, it's a skilled trade. You have to know what you're doing, but he had a hard time. He had worked for a while and then he couldn't find work for about 2 years. So he's bouncing around, staying with family members. That's not going too well because, first of all, I don't think it would go too well for anybody staying with family members for 2 years, but he had a contentious relationship with some of his family members. Lastly, you know, the last place he was with his dad, but he was engaged to be married and he couldn't afford a ring. He was here legally in the country. He was actually an immigrant from Guyana, but his green card was about to expire. So he had to get another green card. Well, that costs money. You know, I mean, like, I mean, he has a van. He has to have maintenance on it. I mean, just things to he needed money. He needed money, period. And I think that the prosecution said he wanted a lifestyle that he could not afford. He was always looking up, like, on his phone, the searches that they did talk about that Darren Wint did was for like luxury cars, mm-hmm. and really fancy, you know, kind of like this fancy lifestyle that he was so far away from.
Right.
So the point you make, maybe, I mean, to me, that not that my opinion matters, but to me, it was like the 10-year thing, holding a grudge for 10 years. That's just a long time. I mean, again, like you just said, Dave, I mean, it just seems like if he was so angry about losing his job, you would think this, he would have retaliated or whatever sooner than 10 years. So to us, the motive, we really had to go with the prosecution in that it was all driven by greed.
And it's a really interesting, you know, to Megan's point, you know, his life was really kind of spiraling out of control. And a lot of it revolved around the money that he didn't have, you know, for basic needs. He was bouncing around these various family members, didn't have a place of his own. But there's also, you know, and he was at the beginning of May 2015, he was living with his dad and his stepmom. He was 34 years old at that point. And they had told him, OK, by the end of the month, you got to be out. And this was the beginning of May 2015. And the murders were May 14th. So clearly, you know, you can look at that and see kind of a portrait of somebody who feels boxed in, who feels desperate. But beyond that, there is also something that we know from his searches and from his personality that he was also really enamored of this fantasy, I think you can say, of wealth and an opulent lifestyle. He was searching for luxury cars. In his search history, you know, it's probably dozens, if not hundreds of you know, high-end Corvettes and Dodge Vipers and Range Rovers and
Porsches,
Lamborghinis and Porsches, which is what the kind of car that the Savopoulos family had, in addition to other high-end sports cars. And also something else that we know, he was obsessed with playing the lottery. That's something that his family members testified to during the trial, even to the point of where a family member had given him an old laptop and he would use it to try to calculate numbers. Which I wasn't really familiar with, but apparently it is a thing where people try to game the system, you know, try to pick the winning numbers. And after the murders, when the $40,000 ransom had been delivered, Darren Wint was at the gym with a friend, and he had a very large wad of cash. Nobody had ever seen him with that much money before. And when he was asked where he got it, he said, "I won the lottery."
So that all fits a narrative he'd created for quite a while. It wouldn't be something that would immediately set off people's red flags or alarms.
Also, kind of psychologically, it was kind of like for him, because a lot of people have looked at $40,000 and been like, well, I mean, the Savopoulos family had much, you know, likely much more money at their disposal. you know, so why 40,000? And some of that is like, you know, logistically, how much could be withdrawn from a bank and dropped off relatively quickly. But, you know, to Darren Wimp, $40,000 is a lot of money, would be a lot of money. And I think that, you know, for him, that might be a year's income. And, you know, just to have it kind of dropped in his lap after, you know, committing four brutal murders, maybe it did feel like winning the lottery.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly solved his problems if you want to look at it that way. I mean, you can afford to get an engagement ring and green card and to move to New York on 40 grand.
What price of life, right?
And I know,
and here you've got an entire family, and well, not an entire family, but the bulk of a family, and their housekeeper wiped out for something that in the cosmic scheme of things is such a minuscule, insignificant amount of money.
And we think that's kind of why, you know, Jack mentioned the calls that the family was making out to people they didn't know and they knew. So like, you know, they had, for example, their dogs were supposed to go to this like pet care thing. So they called them. OK, maybe they're not going to recognize the tone of voice is a little off. But Sava called his sister, who was the CFO of his company, and said, you know, I'm going to need 40 grand tomorrow. And we can talk about, you know, I don't want to tangent right now, but we can talk about why that didn't raise flags. But we think part of the reason that, I mean, he was trying to get out of this alive. He was trying to get his family out of this alive. So maybe 40 grand was what he could get Darren Wint and survive this thing. You know what I mean? They were trying not to raise red flags.
Right.
That's my point. Yeah.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into that. First up, we have to take a break. Stay tuned. We've got more of the best in paranormal and true crime talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is Beyond the Darkness. Hey, everybody. You have to check out this amazing new true crime podcast. It's called 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. It's about a murder that took place in Washington, D.C. A family and their housekeeper held hostage for 22 hours before being killed when the murderers set their mansion on fire. You'll be shocked by what they went through during those 22 hours, and you won't believe how they found this guy. I'm not going to ruin the ending, but all I'll say is pizza crust. I'm telling you, this is awesome. Podcast One teamed up with award-winning journalists from news giant WTOP to put this story together, and the podcast is great. Download 22 Hours, An American Nightmare now on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. New episodes every Monday.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're lucky enough today to have the reporters behind this amazing series, Megan Clardy, Jack Moore, are here with us right now. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare. I do want to tell people what's great about this. It's not just the two of you chatting and discussing this case. You're presenting this case much in the narrative that we've all come to love on true crime television programs. You've included audio actualities of firefighters, the court, police, people involved. It's really, and I don't say this lightly, it's a stunning podcast. And just that's in the first episode. People that love this episodic version and want to really get deeply into a crime, you guys have presented a compelling program, and it's heartbreaking, the story, but what an amazing story to tell. Thank you very much for keeping the victims and their story alive in this as well.
Thank you. I mean, I think it was clear to us the evidence that we had from the U.S. Attorney's Office, like those voicemails the family left when they called out. We had the 911 tape from the man who discovered the fire. We had firefighter calls. So it didn't immediately. It's like, this isn't going to be a podcast where Jack and I talk. You know, I mean, we want to present this thing like it happened. And when we were out, I actually was out covering the 6-week trial. I was there for every day of the 6 weeks. If Jack wasn't there, you know, we kind of tag teamed it. But I would call back. DC Superior Court doesn't allow any audio or video recording inside court. So I'd have to run outside, whether it was raining or snowing or whatever, and just call Jack and say, you know, hey, this is the spelling of this person's name, and this is who we're expecting today to take the stand, and you know, nuts and bolts. But it also ended up being almost like an audio diary of our reporting of the case, because there were some days, you know, like the autopsy day.
Right.
I am not used to, as a reporter, having any feeling about anything. It doesn't matter how I feel. I'm supposed to report what happened. But I'm talking to my friend, you know, I'm talking to my colleague right after just telling him what I saw. And we have that kind of that raw reaction from me, which it took me a little while to get comfortable sharing that, because I feel like it's my, you know, in my DNA not to put my feeling into a story. But it's so audio driven that we decided to put it together almost. I mean, it's similar, if you haven't heard it, to kind of like a Dateline or something, where we pull you through the story as it happens. And we let the content and the sound pull us through. Jack and I go to all the locations and bring you to all the locations with us. And as we, you know, just because we were covering this trial day by day, we don't go through every single day of the trial, but we kind of go along with the listener through the major revelations of this case and say, to, you know, and we talk about it. We're like, you know, this didn't make sense. How could he have gotten through that door? Because that door was locked, or whatever it is, you know? So we're kind of like going through the process, thought process with you until we get to the end.
And with the trial, one thing we should say, and this goes back to a point that Megan and I both made earlier, you know, when there was this rumor and speculation that there had to be other people involved, and then, you know, we never heard anything for 3 years, and then the trial started. Well, when the trial started, Darren Wendt's defense team dropped a bombshell. Because his defense was, I'm innocent. I didn't have anything to do with this. It was my two brothers who committed this crime. And that presented a challenge for us in covering it, because now we had a whole alternative theory of the case to consider. And from an evidentiary perspective, without getting too in the weeds, but, you know, because forensic evidence did come into play, and some DNA evidence is not unique to you. It's also shared by your siblings. So if your defense is, I didn't do it, two of my siblings did it, well, there's a potential that some of this DNA evidence could be a match to other suspects. So the trial was, you know, there were two competing versions of the truth, and we were trying to figure out which one was actually the truth and which one was a lie.
Wow, to involve your family members and try to throw them under the bus. I mean, it's one thing to say, hey, I wasn't there, or maybe even because I knew the family and I worked for them, I was just a pawn in this. I was pushed into this to be the recognizable face to this family. Somebody else orchestrated this plot. That at least seems to make sense, but to throw your own brothers or family, I can see how that would make this suddenly look like there's a lot more to examine. And the idea that maybe more than one person was involved. How long did they entertain the idea that maybe he did have a hand in it, but his brothers were involved as well?
That's a difficult question, because one of his brothers was actually detained with Darren when he was initially arrested. He was there with him. So from the outside, we see, you know, we see on the list of people who are arrested, one of, you know, Darrell Wendt. We're like, well, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, does he have something to do with it? He was never charged. It made things complicated covering it, because we only put somebody's name out there and accuse them of doing anything if they're charged. If there's, you know, if police find enough evidence and reasonable doubt that they could have done this thing. And now we have two people who could be and ended up being innocent, but they are now pulled into this defense, and we had to report, you know, what the defense was. So we kind of struggle with that from a journalistic standpoint, because it's like these two people are just getting blamed for this thing, but we can't not say their names because there's two of them, and it gets confusing and just writing basically that issue. But then we also have the drama in the courtroom, Dave, was unreal, because you have the family, you have the Savopoulos family, the parents of Amy and Sava came almost every single day. Amy's dad was there every day. And you have him, you know, just, I can't even imagine, right, how they're feeling, and their family's been torn apart by this crime. And then you have Darren Wendt on the other side of the courtroom, who is tearing apart his own family. And his brother, both his brothers take the stand. One of his brothers gets up there and turns to him and says, I mean, basically, I can't believe you're doing this. I think he said, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in you, man. And just to think of, not only do you have the family that is grieving for the people they lost, you have a man who's accused of a quadruple murder, tearing apart his own family, and all of the logistics that go into that, and, you know, whether how he was being supported. And it was just unreal to see these two families kind of being, you know, dissolving in front of your eyes.
And it was really, you know, the trial was fascinating because it really took the justice system and kind of tilted it on its ear, because then you had the defense attorneys who were acting like almost like prosecutors, you know, saying, well, where were you? And, you know, they would present, you know, part of an alibi, like, well, that's not good enough because.
To the brothers, you mean?
Right. Yeah. And then the prosecutors were almost acting like defense attorneys for the two brothers who they said were being falsely accused by a guy who was trying to get away with murder. So it was disorienting, you know, to think, okay, here's the role of a prosecutor, here's the role of a defense attorney, and they would completely shift depending on the day of the trial.
Does this, I mean, it, first of all, just kind of going back to what you said regarding his own family, man, we can't believe you're doing this, you know, we're disappointed. You would think that the initial reaction would be, we're disappointed that you would do a crime like this, that you would have a hand in this, but It does seem strange to me that they were pointing out, hey, man, to involve us in this is really disappointing. Do you know where I'm going? I mean, I think it's just partly, interesting take.
Partly it has to do with the length of time, because the brothers never were mentioned in any connection, really, until the trial started 3 years later. So I imagine the initial reactions of, oh, my God, I can't believe my brother was involved in this was 3 years ago, you know, and then. So to imagine, you know, a family member could be the suspect in one of the most brutal crimes in Washington, D.C. recent history. And then fast forward 3 years and he's trying to say, no, I really didn't do it. You did. I mean, that. So I think the reaction could just, you know, be a function of the time.
Did they try to play that as though, you know, this was a grasping at straws concept, or was it he was trying to protect his other brothers for as long as he could? But now it was getting to the point where if he didn't acknowledge that they were part of this, he would be the sole person being hung out to dry for this crime.
Well, the brothers were never charged, but it was interesting because part of Darren Wendt's defense includes what happened. And he basically tried to say his brothers did this and he kind of was like tricked into going to the house in the first place, which is why, because he has to put his DNA there somehow, right? I mean, they found the DNA on the pizza in the house, so account for that. So he said that basically the short version of the story is he said his brothers told him that they have a job. He needed money. So he said, sure, I'm in on it, whatever it is. His brother, Stefan, did a lot of like construction, kind of painting, you know, day job kind of work on the side. So that fits. And so he says that they, morning of the job, they say, you know what, man, we don't need you anymore, but we're going to borrow your van. And that they went to the house and the next day pick him up and say, hey, you know, can you help us finish this one thing, this drywall, and bring him over there. And there's a pizza sitting there and he has a piece of the pizza, realizes what's going on, is upset by it and leaves. That's the basic version of his story. And so he put his brothers in there. Now, remember, as Jack said, the evidentiary connection here is one of the pieces of evidence against Darren Wendt, aside from the pizza, is a piece of hair that was found in the bloody bedding in the same room where the adults' bodies were found. Now, that hair, and again, this is all, you know, scientific stuff we've learned and we go into it, but that type of DNA is not nuclear DNA, which would be like blood cells or skin cells, right? Hair is different. So it's mitochondrial DNA. So I have the same mitochondrial DNA as my sister. And, you know, Jack has the same as his sister. It goes by your sibling. So they could say, no, it was Stefan's hair in the bed. So that was the defenses. It could be Darren's. It could be Stefan's. Who says it's not Stefan's? And you couldn't prove it wasn't. So that was part of the reason they had to have Stefan at the house as part of the defense.
Just that plausible deniability, that one more deflection, providing shadow of a doubt.
And I can't imagine. Can you imagine being blamed for something like that? I mean, it's like, let alone it happening in the first place and learning that your sibling is capable of something like that. But then saying, no, 3 years later, we actually need to have you take the stand and tell us where you were the day four people were killed.
You know, like, that's what kind of struck me as kind of notable is if you're never suspected of being involved in a crime, and then 3 years later, somebody says, okay, where were you? Well, of course, your alibi was going to be a little fuzzy because that, you know, that day otherwise does not stick out to you. You know, if Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, as opposed to if somebody comes to you the day after and says, where were you last night at 8 o'clock p.m.? Because there's a murder and you might be a suspect. Well, you know, I'm sure I could rally a bunch of, oh, they saw me. I was at the grocery store. I was at. Mm-hmm. But 3 years later, I don't, you know, if you ask me what I was doing May 14th, 2015, I don't know that I could give you an answer that would stand up, you know,
on hour by hour.
Right. Yeah. You know, so I think that was kind of. That was difficult for us to parse out as journalists because we wanted to be fair. We wanted to give a fair hearing to Darren Wendt's defense, but we also didn't want to needlessly accuse people and kind of raise doubts about them when they hadn't been charged, when the prosecutors had completely dismissed the defense's theory. You know, but we also know prosecutors can make mistakes too. So it really was challenging for us to be fair, you know, but also not to feel like we were being, you know, taken in by some guy's story just because he wants to get away with murder.
The depth of the depravity in this crime is also quite disturbing, right? For $40,000 to end the life of four people. And
a child.
What, it's right, like, what, such an insignificant amount of money for nothing. Is there a turning point? Was this going off without a hitch, or do you believe that Darren Wendt knew from the start people are going to die today?
You know what's weird, Dave, is we don't have any evidence that he planned this. We don't have any evidence that he didn't. But I mean, what was all the murder weapons could be accounted for inside the house before he got there.
So we don't know that he brought weapons with him, you know, so that is one of those things that we just don't know still. You know, was he going there initially? Was he just going to rob the place? Was he going to, you know, steal from the house and then things went wrong? Or was there, did he have some kind of inkling of a plan worked out, but maybe not all the way to murder? But then he realized, you know, in order to get away with this, I mean, what good is $40,000 if you're, you know, if they recognize you and you're going to be arrested the next day?
We do know that prosecutors believe that he had taken Amy, the mother, Philip, the child, and Vera, the housekeeper, hostage. And after they were all taken hostage, Amy makes a call to Sava, her husband, and basically says, you have to come home. And it was not it for a number of different reasons, without getting into boring your listeners and getting into the details of it. But he was about to open this big studio. It was like crunch time professionally for him. It was a crazy time for your wife to be like, hey, I need you to come home and help out with the kid tonight. It's like, no, what? I have this huge thing going on. How could you possibly ask me that? And so she really had to sell it. I mean, she really had. No one knows what she said on the phone because they talked. We didn't have a voicemail of that. But somehow she gets him to come home on the brink of this major opening that he has like 2 days later. And I think, I mean, the prosecutors were able to prove that it was because they needed Sava to get the money, right? They needed him to start facilitating the money to be dropped off at the house. But it, to me, it was like, well, did he even know anybody was home? Was he thinking maybe Sava was going to be home and he could get the money from the house? Did he think they had that much money in the house? I think because there was no evidence of a plan, it then makes your mind go in a million different directions of what could have happened. And obviously, we don't report that because that's all speculation. But yeah, I mean, there's a big question mark and it's a very frustrating one.
That makes you even, I mean, to look at the scope of this entire story and realize there may have been no plan other than just getting in there at the start and then kind of running this plan through while he's on the ground, you know, boots on the ground doing this. How does somebody like this just get access to this area, to this home, to be let in if he has no weapons with him that we're aware of? Now, well, just because he used the items that were in the house to kill or bludgeon or destroy doesn't mean that he didn't maybe have a weapon on him to force his way into the house that he didn't use. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah. I mean, we don't know. He could have had a gun and left with a gun, or had a crowbar and left with a crowbar. They never were able to prove either how he got in the house. But that's one of the news we break with this podcast is the family had another housekeeper who had worked for the family for 20 years. She knew the ins and outs of that house, man. She knew the routine. She knew where the recycling bin was, where the random dishes were. I mean, she knew everything about that house. And she was in the courtroom when the prosecutors put up crime scene photos. And they're going through almost kind of trying to orient the jury. You know, this is where the kitchen was. This is kind of how it was laid out. You get to the kitchen through the garage type thing. And she sees something in those crime scene photos that no one else sees. And that is, I mean, I kind of hate to give it away, but basically we have it in our episode 3 that she thinks she knows, based on those crime scene photos, how Darren Wint got in the house. And she couldn't say it on the stand because it's not fact. I mean, she didn't see him walk in that way, right? But she thinks she knows just based on what, you know, certain things were placed in certain places, and she has an idea.
And logistically, it is frustrating. Why that is a bit of a question is because the family had two fairly large dogs, Chesapeake Bay Retriever dogs, who were known to be aggressive at times. So if you have a stranger coming into the house in a threatening manner, how was he able to get past them and subdue them? So her theory of how this could have happened also accounts for that. But one of the things, you know,
when in this, it's speculation. So she's not allowed to bring it up. The courts hear it and there's an objection. How does that even get brought up?
She was never asked about it on the stand, but we interviewed her.
Oh, later. It's something that you uncover later. Certainly. All right.
And it was something that she saw in the crime scene photo. So then it was knowledge that she didn't have until the trial, you know, that she just happened to be sitting in the courtroom when they showed those photos. And then when we interviewed her after the trial, that's after she'd had her kind of realization.
And when you examine different aspects of this, as you mentioned, I mean, you're reporters. You've got to remain somewhat objective to what happens. You know, how do you report this? It's easy to shine the spotlight on the wrong people and the wrong time, right? And have something, you know, you certainly don't want to create like a Stephen Avery, Brendan Dassey situation where all of a sudden, you know, because they've had the spotlight on them before, is this something you want to do now? So you've got to be very cautious in how you approach this. But did her accounting seem to make sense? And has anybody brought this to the attention of law enforcement since?
It does make sense. It makes sense to me. I think it makes sense to Jack. Honestly, it was interesting to me. I think this is the first trial of this length that I ever sat through. And I was expecting them really to answer all the questions. You know, I mean, why wouldn't they? How did he get in? What did he use? Did he have weapons? How did he get to the house? I mean, all these questions that we had. And they don't have to prove how he did it. They have to prove that he did it. And so in the end, the prosecutor, Laura Bach, who works for the U.S. Attorney's Office here in the district, said, you know, we're not saying that Darren Wint didn't have help. We're saying Darren Wint was there. We're saying Darren Wint did this. So if later more people, you know, we find more DNA or something else, you know, comes to light that we can prosecute other people, we will. But she was saying this to the jury. It doesn't matter if you think more than one person did this. Do you think Darren Wint did this? And going to your question, remember when I mentioned his brother was one of the people who was arrested, you know, with him detained for a minute while he was Darren Wint was arrested. I think one of the lessons I've learned from reporting this story. I mean, I'm kind of mid career. I've been reporting for about 15 years now, and you know to get it right before you get it first. I mean, that's one of the main tenets of journalism. Don't just jump to conclusions and report something that isn't correct. But when you have sort of the impressions that are made upon you as a human being, that leads you to jump to conclusions, and you have to check yourself constantly that you aren't reporting your own conclusions. And I think one of the things that I noticed about myself in this, in my understanding of this case, was when he was arrested with 5 other people, I was thinking to myself, well, you're a quadruple murderer and you're arrested with 5 other people, and you're telling me that none of those 5 people know anything about what happened? Please. You know, I was kind of like, there's got to be some kind of connection or something or somebody who knows something. And it turns out we reported it correctly. Yes, he was arrested with 5 other people. They were detained. They were let go. But they really didn't have anything to do with it. And we learned about that in court. And so it sort of was a lesson to me journalistically that don't jump to conclusions. I mean, let things sort of play out and see, because a lot of times things will make more sense later. But don't just assume, right, that just because somebody is in someone else's company, they have any idea. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It totally does. And I'm glad to hear somebody that's a reporter and part of the media stating that claim out loud, because look how many people jump to fact because this was mentioned early on in the case and make assumptions. And in the ever increasing need for network television and cable news sources to constantly try to break new news in instances like this, that would have been easy to glom onto and spend 8 hours talking on CNN about this as the story is unfolding, right? About this one nugget. And that's something that people take away. And again, when you're speculating and pontificating about, you know, what this means, it doesn't mean that there's any legitimacy or truth to what your theory might be. By jumping to those conclusions, you can actually muddy the waters considerably when it comes to reporting these type of crimes.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think I was wrong in thinking that. I think it was probably natural to think that, you know, how could they have let four people go if or five people go if they're looking for more people who were involved in this thing? I think everybody, I mean, we were talking around the newsroom, like, what's going on in this investigation? You just have natural questions. And we reported the facts. I'm glad we just stuck to the facts, because in the end, the facts are what carried the case.
When you're examining this case and breaking it down, talking to these people, and kind of looking at this with a set of fresh eyes, and I don't want to give everything away. I want people to listen to the entire podcast. It's brilliantly done. But in kind of re-examining this case and looking, is it frustrating to you as journalists to see how much or how many things were buried, mishandled? And I don't mean that lightly, as though, you know, oh, the law was wrong or this or that. But I mean just that there are some glaring instances that, boy, this should have been brought up during the trial. This should have been brought up during this entire procedure.
So I think that there were some things that we had questions about, because there was a fire in this house. I mean, we talked to a criminologist, and fire, honestly, is a criminal's best friend, right? I mean, he said, if you want to get rid of stuff, you burn it, because it does. It destroys DNA. It expedites the time that things break down. I mean, all obvious things that we know. But there were pieces of evidence in the house that we're talking about, like, it's a $4 million house. It was huge. And so you're going through for police in the middle of May in D.C. I don't know if anybody's been to D.C., but it is hot. It's a muggy town in May. And so they turn off the air conditioning. Obviously, all the power is cut to the house. And these officers are sweating, you know, having a hard time doing their job. And there was one thing. I mean, we break down certain pieces of evidence that either were not collected, that were pointed out to be collected. Who knows if they were, you know, would end up changing the crime at all. We don't know. But there was one thing that really we latched onto and really became a big part of the trial. And it was a knife in a basement window. And I don't even know where to start with this, because it's so complicated. But basically, there was a question of, so Darren Wentz trace DNA. So I'm talking like you brush the side of a table. Not like you pick it up with a sweaty hand, right? Just very, 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 very small amount of DNA is on the handle of this knife. His defense attorney tries to prove that he didn't even have to touch that knife for his trace DNA to get on it. If I shook your hand, Dave, and then I touched something else, I could get your DNA on that item. So she says that's the case with trace DNA. Did Darren Wentz open the basement window and prop it open with a knife? Did the evidence techs get really hot in the basement of a giant house in DC in May and prop open the window after touching another piece of evidence? There were a lot of, I mean, this, it was basically the only piece of evidence that could have been used as a weapon that Darren Wentz's DNA was on.
Well, and also it's a piece of evidence that doesn't fit with his story of what happened, because he said he was at the house, but he never said he went to the basement. So every other piece of forensic evidence was accounted for in his story, except for this knife propping open the basement window. But the knife in the basement window was like a total non sequitur. Nothing, as far as we know, happened in the basement. You know, no part of the crime took place in the basement. And we don't believe that the knife propping open the window was the way that he got into the house, because the windows were too small and kind of those basement windows that are set up high into a wall, you know, in the basement. So it was one of those things we never could figure out what was the purpose. Right. But the only thing is his DNA was on this knife. So how did it get there?
The other weird thing was not all of, but some of the other basement windows were also propped open with random things, with like a Frisbee that was probably in the basement somewhere. And there was another one propped open with what looked like a child's block.
So which would support the idea that, you know, perhaps the evidence technicians in the basement got hot and just propped open the windows for airflow. But that, you know, kind of reduces the possibility that then the killer before that would have propped open a window with a knife. If, you know, it's really a rabbit hole in the case. But I mean, it's a key piece of evidence against Darren Wynn, key piece of forensic evidence that is really hard to parse out in any version of the timeline, in any version of the story.
So answering your question in a very, very long way, I mean, basically there were a lot of, it's not everything's black and white, right? Especially in these really complicated and complex cases is that we never say that evidence was mishandled per se, but there's questions about the evidence that nobody really can answer.
I know you don't want to give too much away, but in your estimation, do you believe this was the work of one person, or do you think that there are still secrets to be revealed in this case?
Well, I think one of the things that was the question that I think everyone had, reporters and people who are familiar with the case, and the trial really did help provide some answers. And what we want to do is use that as our guide and bring the listener along. So we present all of the evidence that came out of the trial. And that's really the question that was resolved by the trial. But I think to a point Megan brought up earlier, you know, kind of what was eye-opening for me, and maybe it was naive to think this way from the beginning, but I too thought that we would get answers to everything, that everything would be laid out in a book, you know, beginning, middle, and end, and we could just close the book and say everything is explained. And that's just not, you know, I think that is a function of maybe too much fiction crime shows and, you know, that to think that, because there are some mysteries about the case that remain. You know, the jury rendered its verdict. Darren Wynn is appealing. He's always maintained his innocence. So we'll see what happens. I think our podcast, you know, for now, I think what we'd like to say is that we present all the evidence. And at the end of the day, our podcast is not a whodunit. You know, we don't have like some kind of smoking gun alibi witness or something like that, you know, but we're trying to take the listener along the way to show the way that this trial answered questions and also left some remaining.
It was interesting too, Dave. I kind of feel like there were a lot of points in this trial where, you know, I would leave court and call Jack and just be like, oh, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't fit. And we talked to a former U.S. attorney who actually worked with Robert Mueller later in his career. He's a very accomplished guy. And he said, you know, life is messy. Life doesn't end. Things don't go ba-boom, 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 and everything works out perfectly. I mean, you butt dial people, or you make a wrong turn, and then you turn around. Or, you know, like nothing is always, life isn't always just, you know, point A to point B. And I think a lot of that is we have to kind of accept that there are things in this case we won't know. But for the listener, I mean, we do a little good cop, bad cop, and sort of go down each road, you know, like could other people have done this? Could he have had help? Was he hired by somebody? I mean, like we kind of, I think we entertain the idea that obviously in presenting the defense that this could have been done by more than one person. I mean, in the end, prosecutors prove that Darren Wynn did it, but
and we show what the evidence proves. You know, this is a theory raised by the defense, and here's what the evidence says.
In the entire overlook of this case, where there's still, I mean, it was covered for quite a while. There was a lot of evidence and information that was revealed during court. Are there still, as you're digging deeper, are there still questions that are being raised that not necessarily who done it, but other questions about how certain aspects of this case even developed? And I'm being vague on purpose because I don't want to give away some of your secrets. But I mean, is it interesting to you that all these years later, there's still aspects of this case that should be a lot clearer than they are?
I think so. I mean, there's, like we said about Darren Wynn's phone, you know, we don't know where he was. There's a lot of things, like, for example, he went to go get his car all the way in downtown D.C. We don't know why his car was parked there. Sava's cell phone pings off a DuPont Circle cell phone tower while he's being held hostage. Who had his phone? Why was his phone in DuPont Circle? I mean, there are questions definitely that we still have. And that's really what fueled us doing the podcast, because you want this to be a closed book. And there are so many questions remaining. And I don't think necessarily that any of the questions we have point to another person. I sort of wish they did, just from a journalistic perspective. You hope you uncover something that, you know, a bombshell or something. But I think part of the reason we really struggled for a little while to even do it, because it's like, you know, this case is over. Someone's been convicted. Let this family move on. You know, I mean, what's the value in bringing all of this up? And we found as journalists, not only, I mean, well, as human beings, not only did we have so many questions and so many things we wanted to share, but we had so many details that weren't reported that maybe could lead, you know, we talked to this housekeeper who didn't even have that revelation until after she was off the stand. Maybe somebody will hear this and say, oh, that's weird. I didn't realize that, you know, that one little detail that then that affects my life. And I realized maybe I could contribute to the police investigation into somebody else. I mean, you never know the details that we're going to report in this thing and what difference they're going to make. And I think it also is sort of, I mean, community service might be strong, but there, you know, our community was rocked by this. I mean, this was a major crime. It made us all feel a little unsafe in your own home. You know, I mean, we talked to jurors afterwards and they said, you know, should I come up with some kind of, like, you know, phrase that if something happens to me, my loved ones will know that something's wrong. I mean, I think it just gets into your psyche. So we thought it was important to let our community and everybody who was interested in this case know everything that was brought up in trial and all of the defense claims and why that wouldn't work and why it would. And I mean, this is a very, like, kind of complicated answer to your question, but I mean, I think this is worth retelling because there could be a revelation out there. It could possibly lead to someone else if there is somebody else who was involved in this thing. And if there isn't, maybe it's just telling people, you know, this is what happened in your community. This is the details of a public trial that took place. So you can listen to it yourself.
How do I want to phrase this? All of the things that took place in that 22 hours. And the calls, how many wheels were in motion during that segment that, you know, for money and other, you know, calling in sick to work or, you know, all of the excuses that had to be given. What information have you uncovered in that? And what can you tell us at this point?
So there was, I mean, at least a dozen calls. And these were all established during the trial, you know, when they were going point by point to establish, you know, exactly what happened to this family and to their housekeeper. One of the interesting things, though, in the trial is not everything is presented chronologically, because you have to remember they're calling, you know, basically the way evidence can be introduced at a trial is, OK, let's say the family made a call to Domino's Pizza, which they did. So they call as a witness the assistant manager from Domino's Pizza who took that phone call, and they put him on the stand and they say, okay, on May 13th at 9:14 PM, you received a call from, and she sound, you know, and how did she sound? But then their next witness that they call might be a forensic analyst who was, you know, testing bits of evidence
like 3 weeks later.
our understanding of the timeline was not chronological. So what we had to do after the trial is we put everything in order, you know, and we go throughout the podcast minute by minute in some cases where we have that specificity of detail to say at this time they're calling, and then we know, you know, this is happening, and then this. And, you know, one of the haunting things, as Megan mentioned earlier, is that, you know, for these dozen at least calls that were made, nobody seemed to know that anything, you know, was wrong at all. So it's haunting for them, I'm sure.
I was talking earlier, Dave, about all the details that come out of this. You know, I mean, it's hard to, I mean, they all need context to even make sense. And it felt like in the trial that it was like somebody had cut up a piece of paper into a million little pieces and just like thrown it all over the floor. And we were supposed to pick up the little pieces and put the paper back together. It was like, how are we going to take 6 weeks, 8 hours a day of testimony and make it chronological and make it make sense? And it goes, I mean, it really goes to Jack and how hard he worked. He, I mean, his Google Doc skills are on point at this at this point. I mean, he literally, we just have like the time call, like the timestamps of the calls that were made, the cell phone pings, the time that, you know, little alerts on the security system that they had in the house that was not activated that day, which answers that question, I'm sure, is going to be next. I mean, it was a monstrous task. And it really speaks to how hard Jack specifically has worked on laying all of these details out and then, you know, working on the scripts together and making it really a story that pulls you in.
It certainly has. And in the first episode, and there's a teaser episode out there as well on Podcast One, you can check out. You've really, I mean, you come out swinging. This is a great first episode. I can't wait to see how the next nine unfold. And I know the original concept was, you know, to try to tell this story within 10 episodes. I'm curious as you continue to dig, and you said this is an ongoing process. What more could possibly be shown? And I think that there is more to this mystery, at least in getting to the intricacies, as you mentioned, into finally maybe trying to make sense or understand some of these bits that were left kind of out there. Is he still maintaining, Darren Wendt, is he still maintaining his innocence, fighting for appeals? What can you tell us about him at this point?
Yes, he maintains his innocence. He was sentenced in February to 4 life sentences without the possibility of parole, which is the harshest penalty in the District of Columbia, which does not have capital punishment. In his case, is his attorneys have filed paperwork to appeal. And now this appeals process could take the better part of a decade, to be honest. It the wheels of justice grind very slowly. So this is a story that will continue to unfold for years.
It's complicated, too, because he's appealing. That really limits us into who we can talk to. Right. So like the prosecutors aren't going to talk to us if they know it's being appealed. They don't want to like let the cat out of the bag with all their strategy and all everything they didn't want to give us on a silver platter because they may have to use it again, you know. And same goes for the defense. We've actually contacted Darren Wendt in prison. He's in prison in Louisiana, and asked him if he wants to share his story with us and, you know, what he thinks. And I mean, any of the millions of questions we have for him. There's a lot to this case. Actually, we have also asked D.C. Superior Court. They basically have a audio recording of everything that happens during trial. So that the stenographers can go back and if they miss a word or something, they can listen to the audio recording and fill in the transcript. Well, we learned about this and we said, well, you know, can we get a copy of those audio recordings? And the court said, no, those aren't public record. Those are not the official record of the court. The transcript is. And so Jack actually found a Supreme Court case that challenges that and says, you know, we basically said, you know, if it's a public space, it's public record, that should be able to be released to the public. And so we appealed that to the Chief Justice of D.C. Superior Court, who is now taking our request under review and could possibly release those audio recordings to us, which only helps us in our storytelling. So, you know, something could happen with the appeal. Something could happen with our request for audio. We could hear from one of, you know, the people who we've reached out to who so far have been through hell and back and didn't want to talk about it, but maybe they're going to change their minds. There's a lot of ways. Jack's famous line here is, we know how the case ends, but we don't know how this podcast ends, because it could be, you know, it's changing as we go.
Could you tell us before we wind up here, with all that took place in that house during that time, how many calls do we know for certain were placed, and how hard did it seem for them to acquire this $40,000?
So I would have to go back to my Google Doc to tell you the exact number of calls. It was at least a dozen. I mean, between a dozen and probably 20 calls. And how hard was it to get the money? Well, I don't know. It's hard to quantify. He had to make several calls to the CFO of his company, to the controller of his company. Since he was not going to go into the office to sign the check, they had to do some kind of digital signature. So there was a series of calls to get the money, but in the end, it was, I mean, he called early that morning and the money was dropped off a few hours later.
We've had a couple questions too from people who say, you know, how not every bank has like 40 grand sitting around. I mean, and that's true. They had to call a couple different banks, but you have to remember he was the CEO of a company that worked in a lot of cash, right? It's a construction company. So part of the reason the 40 grand didn't raise flags when he asked for it to be withdrawn is because Savo would often go to auctions and buy like pretty specialized equipment that would cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. So when he asked for 40 grand, it was like, okay, well, he's probably going to an auction. I think I have always wondered if he asked for, you know, I need $1 million. It's like, that's weird.
Well, I mean, that would have immediately raised concern.
Right. You know, but 40 grand, normal. It's like, okay, maybe he's, you know, maybe he's doing something this weekend that he just hasn't told us about. He's the boss. I'm not going to question him. And even
then he sounds completely normal on the phone. You know, so he's maybe joking. He's, you know, he just sounds like his normal self.
That is kind of eerie. One of the voicemails we have that he made to his assistant to actually pick up the money and drop it off at his house is like breezy. I mean, that's how I would describe it. It's like, hey, man, we got to change your voicemail. I just wanted to see if you could, you know, do a favor for me. It's like very like you just I don't know. I mean, obviously, I didn't know Sava Savopoulos, but when you hear that voicemail, you think there's nothing going wrong there. It's a totally normal scenario. So coordinating the money obviously was a lot easier for him than it would be, say, for me or Jack, because he had access to that kind of cash. But getting it to the house, I mean, it was sort of a staged production a little bit as how they got it to the house, where it was left and when, and the timeline of all of it.
Well, Megan and Jack, let me ask you this then. Is there any chance that there was financial problems brewing for this family, that this was something orchestrated and the initial intent of what was to happen went south on them once Darren Wint got involved and realized maybe he could just have the money for himself?
It's interesting, Dave. It's you're doing the same thing that I think we've been doing for 4 years. It's like your mind goes, well, what if this? Well, what if that? Well, what if he was hired by somebody? Well, what if it was an inside job? I mean, we have no evidence, none, that the family was under any duress financially, that the business was under any strain at all. I mean, they never brought that up in court, which doesn't necessarily mean it isn't true, but we can only report what we know. And we don't know that that was any motivating factor, that there were any financial problems at all. All we know is that Darren Wint walked out of that house with 40 grand and four people lost their lives.
What a tragedy. But do you know in their family, was there any financial issues coming up? Was he a gambler? Was there drug addiction or anything like that that might give us even a flicker of an instant of why, you know, what might be a reason for him to sound so breezy and trying to get this money? Was he trying to do this and then make it seem as though this was a for hostage situation so that insurance would cover it or, you know, he would get the money, get away with the money and have this. And I certainly don't want to deflect and make the victims seem like they're possibly part of the perpetrators. But it just seems like you're saying, that seems bizarre, doesn't it? That it's just so breezy. I mean, you make a call, your life is on the line. The family's life is on the line to get this money. Comments like, hey, man, time to change your voicemail. That seems superfluous. That seems like an aspect of this that wouldn't take place. You'd be so focused on acting, trying not to sound like you're acting, you know, getting everything done, that you would skip little pleasantries like that and just been like, hey, man, give me a quick call. I got a couple things going on. I need your help.
I mean, again, police looked into his business. I mean, they went down all of those avenues. We actually interview a police captain, the homicide captain here in D.C., about like, what did you start with? I mean, you have four victims, all of their lives. You know, I mean, like you're multiplying who could be involved in this thing right out of the gate just because of the number of victims you have. And they said they chased down, I mean, that you start basically with the business. I mean, that seems to be the most obvious thing. There is absolutely no evidence of any that even they were on prescriptions. I mean, like, we don't have evidence at all that there were any health issues, any drug issues. We have their two daughters who were enrolled in private schools, boarding schools, that were pretty expensive schools, and they were enrolled for the next year. I mean, we don't have any reason to believe that Sava had anything to do with this. And I think it's fair. I mean, it's a fair question to ask, you know, what was who could have been involved in this? But we've never the prosecution never went there. And I don't think, again, what they
because
did
there's
say
no ev- because there's no evidence.
You right. Know, but again, they did say, you know, the reason he's breezy because is because he has to sound like himself. If Darren Wint sees that he's trying to send any message or be, you know, super serious or sound threatened or anything, his 10-year-old kid's in the other room. We think he was, I mean, we know that he died when he was tortured. Your kid. And so I think at that point you're saying, I am going to do anything I can. If that means making a stupid call that makes me sound like, you know, everything's fine, I'm going to do that. And his sister, Debbie Masser, got up on the stand and said, I believe that he could have done it. And maybe that's the reason why Sava made the majority of the calls, is because he had the wherewithal to kind of keep his cool. We don't know. I mean, it's hard because you can't, again, we don't want to speculate about, you know, we can't report speculation and what was going on in that house, because nobody really knows except for Darren Wint.
Thank you so much again for coming on and spending some time with us and talking about this case. It's fascinating, and I can't wait, like I know many of our listeners, to hear how this story continues to develop and the things that you uncover on this this journey. Very exciting. And for those of us that are really true crime fans, Megan Clougherty, Jack Moore have put together an amazing project with this podcast. And I think you guys have a hit on your hands. So good work with that. And please keep us in mind, and let's revisit once all the episodes have aired and maybe have a chance to chat a little bit more about what other things have come up during this. As you said, one episode's out, you're hearing from people and getting different aspects and insights of this. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that 22 hours, an American nightmare, takes off and an outpouring of information might be coming your way.
Well, we can only hope. I mean, we've worked for 4 years on this project getting to this point, and we really want people to get back to us. If anything, you know, hits your memory or jogs your memory or anything that you think is interesting or we should consider, definitely reach out. We have at the end of our podcast, you know, this is a work in progress. So reach out to us if you have comments or questions. We are going to interact with everybody who does. And we really appreciate you taking the time to have, you know, our case on, our podcast on, and Jack and I, you know, to ask us these questions. Thank you.
Certainly. 22 Hours, an American Nightmare, produced by WTOP with Megan Clougherty and Jack Moore. You can find it here on Podcast One and iTunes. So make sure you go subscribe. Don't miss an exciting minute of this case. And make sure to tell your friends, family, and relatives about this. Spread it through work. Spread it to everybody that you know. And make sure that you rate and review these podcasts, because that helps quite a bit to spread the word and give it more notoriety as well. So take that time to acknowledge the great work that's being put into podcasts like this and so many others. Again, thank you, Megan and Jack, for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember, for more of the best in true crime talk radio, to tune in to True Crime Tuesday. You can find all the information about that program on our website at darknessradio.com. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This has been Beyond the Darkness.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. cold foam cold brew coffee and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have 80 to 120 milligrams, whew, of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,